And the first speaker of today is Professor Milner from the University of Loughborough.
Yep.
And the title is Networks, Subnetworks, and Macroprudential Capital Requirements.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, first of all, a big thank you to Rama. I think this whole semester has been quite fantastic. I was fortunate enough to come here for a week back in October, and that was tremendously rewarding. I particularly appreciate this sort of bringing together the multidisciplinary approach, bringing together people on the mathematical modeling side with more econometric approaches, and someone like myself as well. I'm very much an applied and policy economist, but I like to work with co-authors taking a more technical approach. Just give a feel for audience. How many of you, if you're not too shy to raise your hands, but how many would describe yourself as kind of mathematical modelers and sort of people who do the, so Rama definitely would. So I'm sort of guessing it's still the majority of those are here. So what I'm going to show you is embarrassingly simple. It's not going to impress in terms of the complicated and sophisticatedness of the network. I really had a choice of two things to present. I work at Loughborough. It turns out there's a little group of econophysicists at Loughborough. I've been there about 3 years, and almost the first week I was there, it was the third Loughborough conference on econophysics, and my co-author, Yuka, we've developed a partnership through his association with the Department of Physics at Loughborough. We have a couple of papers in the preprint series here, which are probably a more representative example of the kind of work I'm doing collaborating with physicists. This work, though, is much simpler. It comes from my own policy background, and I've worked several years both in Treasury here in the UK. I did a stint as advisor at the Bank of England. I know a lot of people in the policy world. And I've always struggled personally, I think a big challenge for all of us is try and do the type of modeling that connects to the policymakers. That's simple enough for them to be able to use it to help frame their thinking, but not so simple that it loses touch with reality. I think the other thing I have to say is it's very much work in progress, and I'm going to get as far as the subnetwork. I'm not going to get even to the network side. I think this is going to end up as two different papers. Indeed, there's the actual simulation results are. Well, I'm going to come to a stop saying, and I'm about to, and I'm afraid you're not going to see the full amount of work. So my decision was to take work we were just starting on, and it's not. I think it's very promising, but it's not got quite as far as I was originally hoping. Okay. So motivation. I very much appreciate the work which is looking at sort of quite complex networks, but I also think it's quite helpful, again, from a policy point of view, sometimes to start with the basics. So I want to model systemic risk in a simple subnetwork, and I particularly want to have in mind one application, which is commercial property, and I'll talk for a few minutes, actually, why I think that's an important area of focus. So what I've also been thinking about is, before the crisis, I was doing quite a lot of work on some of the standard credit risk models and credit risk instruments. It was a kind of strange experience to be teaching things like credit default swaps in the classroom, and suddenly they're all over the front pages of the newspapers. And I discovered how much I didn't know about them. The other thing that this points to me from a policy angle, and I can't say this is fully established in the paper yet, it's the kind of goal of this line of work. I wonder whether the type of, although there's a huge amount of valuable insight coming out of the type of network modeling that many of us are interested in, I'm still a little bit puzzled in my own mind whether it's being presented in a way which is most usable to policymakers. So one goal of this work is to try and think about linking to much older ideas about large exposure regulation. Large exposure traditionally being thought of as you have exposure to one large counterparty, but I want to think about that more in terms of large exposures to particular risk factors. And I've said, work in progress, it's a long way to go. And the simulations that I'd hoping to have ready, I think they're just going to have to be at the next presentation. So the network, as I said, is extremely simple. So I'm going to think, actually, in the written equations, it's bank A and bank B. And all we've got so far as thinking about is their common exposure to a commercial property market. Could be housing as well, but I'll give you the reason why I focus on commercial property. And a money market link is something which we can also build in terms of loss of confidence, at any rate. Now, I just want this, my own lack of knowledge of Beamer and so on, I didn't quite manage to get the key slide in there, so I'm going to do this way. Yeah, a bit mechanical. So this is the motivation for the commercial property side of things. So this is a recent book chapter, which is the last time I talked in Cambridge, just about a year ago, I was presenting this paper. So with a colleague at Loughborough, Justine, we looked quite carefully at the reasons why UK banks lost money on their sterling, so domestic exposure, as opposed to their international losses. Now, there were substantial international losses. Royal Bank of Scotland lost something in the region of 40 billion on its purchase of ABN AMRO. Most of the UK banks had exposure to structured credit. But at the part of the UK story which has not been told enough is that domestically, this wasn't a housing problem at all. I'll try not to flick it down. Lost the page. Okay, let's be a little bit more careful. Right, so what I've done is comparing pre-crisis and post-crisis cumulative five-year write-off rates. And we can go through the whole story, but I'm going to pick out two here. One is the residential mortgages, which in the UK, despite our fluctuations, are remarkably safe. So that the total write-offs in the pre-crisis period were £500 million, 1% of all bank write-offs. At an average annual rate, it was 0.0%. During this fierce housing crisis that we've experienced in the last huge amounts in the UK press about housing bubble, the total cumulative write-offs have been 3.4 billion. It's 5% of all sterling bank losses. And the annual write-offs on mortgage lending in the UK has been 0.1%. Now, these are banks lending with margins of upwards of 1% on this type of property. So this has not really been a problem. Northern Rock was not driven into difficulties because of any problems of poor quality on its loan book. If we look under, the statistics don't divide this very well, but if you look under non-financial corporations, and something like two-thirds of this is commercial property. Remember, with UK banks, we don't like lending money to companies. It's more than half of this lending is commercial property, and actually the bulk of this losses. So, and that jumped from 6.5 billion to 30.3 billion. 42% of the total losses, and something like the order of 30% of that 42% is commercial property lending. And this was lending done on very fine margins because it's highly competitive.
You mean 30% of
42%? No, I'm sorry. It's about two-thirds of the 42%. Yeah. And the other, by the way, if you look at the other big areas, there's a lot of unsecured credit card lending and other unsecured personal, because these are big margin products. These are where you have the 5, 10% loan margin. So you're building into the design of the product that there should be quite substantial loan losses in these areas. They weren't that much in previous periods, yeah.
This is the share of losses.
So
they don't add up to 100. I'm trying to understand.
These should add up to 100. So this share.
50 and 24.
No, it looks like a bit high.
They're grouped, right? But I don't.
Yeah, this is all lending to individuals. So this is mortgages plus credit cards plus unsecured personal. So, yeah.
Okay. So
anyway, the only point I didn't want to dwell too long on this, but my main point was that commercial property, an old-fashioned form of lending, and actually that's true to quite an extent internationally. The main reason which U.S. banks failed was commercial property. If you look at if you read federal the models that would be used by the FDIC to predict which banks got into trouble, the models that worked were the ones which included commercial property. Lehman Brothers failed because of its exposure to commercial property. So that's a little bit understudied, and that's why we're focusing on that part of the network. Okay, back to this. But what we're going to do is something pretty... So what we want to try and capture is the feedbacks through one bank being overexposed to a particular secured form of lending, and then what the policy and prudential capital issues that arise in that context. So we're going to build on the standard Vasicek portfolio credit model, but what we have to do is to bring in, first of all, an extension to loan losses, because that's not... There's been no standard way of doing that. I think we have a reasonable approach to doing that. And then think about two aspects of systemic feedback. One is fire sale. And you'll see the way we set up the model. Fire sales are not forced on banks. It's actually a choice. And it's the interaction with balance sheet capacity, the degree of capitalization, which will drive the results we get out. So this will be familiar, at least, to a good many of you. The standard Vasicek model... Oops. I keep pressing the wrong button. Yeah. So we're looking at a portfolio. There's the underlying individual obligors have a value which is indexed, as it were, by this normally distributed variable driven by a systemic, or systematic, should we say, systematic risk factor. Rho is the degree of correlation. And then an uncorrelated or idiosyncratic risk as well. And a default, or actually in our model it's going to be impairment. Because one of the things we worked through this, we realized it was important to draw a distinction between loans being impaired and therefore falling in value, and the actual decision to say, no, we can't keep working with this borrower anymore, we can't extend them more credit, we're going to actually terminate or foreclose on the loan and try and sell the property. So what that then delivers straight away, and it's, you know, the attractiveness of this setup, it was used for the Basel II IRB curves, it gives you, given an outturn for the risk factor, it gives you a default rate, which depends on this trigger, and you can work out an unconditional default, which will just depend on the barrier K. And so those sort of parameters can be backed out of data, at least implicitly. So we've done a little bit of fiddling around in Mathematica. And again, this is just replicating work in other papers. But you know, depending on the degree of correlation, the rho, you get very different distributions of the... so this is a PDF of the this portfolio default rate. If rho is... This is... I've lost the table of numbers. But 0.1, you get a fair... There's some variation, but it's still a fairly normal-looking distribution. But if you move up to numbers, this is 0.3, 0.5, 0.3, 0.4, 0.6, 0.8, I think. And you can actually get quite a sharp change in distribution, where if you have very high correlations, like 0.6, 0.8, you end up with most of the time very little default, and then you get relatively occasional episodes. And actually, these ones, as we'll see from the cumulative, the density actually goes a long way beyond this 10% if you have this high correlation rates. For the particular, I think we chose a 2% average default rate. Okay, that's a very standard model. The question then is, how do we amend this and think about bringing in some sort of systemic feedback? And we're going to work through the parameter K. So the basic idea of the paper is to say, look, can we have some systemic effects, which instead of having K being fixed, having K something that shifts? And we think we found a way to do that, and although you know, comments and feedback are going to be pretty helpful. So we need to bring in impairment, because we want to have an effect on the balance sheet. And the balance sheet is not just driven by defaults, especially, or impairment, the rate of impairment, especially in the context of commercial property. It's the valuations that make a huge difference. So a natural way to think about that is to think about, well, this underlying V is also some metric of value. The problem is the dimensionality. So V is in standard deviations. Standard deviations are not pounds, shillings and pence, to use an old-fashioned UK term. So we introduce an extra parameter, phi, which is essentially translating from these value, from the standard deviation units into units of loss. And again, we want to use the same type of approach that Vasicek used to think, let's back out phi from an average through the cycle LGD measure. And you can then say, given an outturn for x and a value for k, or which is the same thing as PD, you can then back out a valuation effect. Now, I emphasize it's not yet termination of the loan. That's going to come in when we look at the decisions of the banks. The way we're describing this, and it's a little bit loose in terms of institutions, but it's tractable, is that outsiders, accountants, credit referencing agents, credit rating agencies, investors, are kind of looking at the portfolio, and their valuation of their perception of the bank's balance sheet is driven by this type of valuation. And we can, you'll see an analogy with Black-Scholes, which is, of course, not surprising. I mean, it's not the same, because we're working with, we're not talking about risk-neutral probabilities, but it's the two, this is the sort of D1 and D2 equivalent. And it's, we can get, this is the conditional impairment, and we can get the unconditional impairment via numerical integration over x, and we can choose phi so that we hit some target for calibration of the model. And this is what we get out of that. So this was one particular, this is, I think this is with rho equals 0.3 in our preferred unconditional default rate, I think was LGD was 20%. We could make that higher. And then what we get out of that are, that's the orange is the default rate out of the original Vasicek model. And then for the outturn of x, that's giving us the actual LGD rate. And I say the average difference in them is 20%. But you're pushed out quite a long, well, you can see in a moment the actual ratios. So this shows the overall losses on the portfolio. Maybe this chart doesn't go quite enough out into the average default rates, especially for these higher, this is 0.6 and 0.8 in terms of correlation. There's quite a lot of the density is out beyond 0.10. But when you've got probably more realistic correlations of 0.5, 0.3, then the portfolio loan losses are fairly tightly linked to the default rate. It's when we get the system, and I think, again, this intuitively makes sense, it's when we bring in the systemic risk interactions that we'll start to get the very, we believe, because the simulations are still in progress, we'll start to get the tighter, the bigger kind of market impacts that we've observed in the crisis. And then that's the average LGD rate, which I say it's actually the, I've double-checked this, so I'm pretty confident it's right. The average LGD is 20%, but remember although the impairment rate is only distributed, there's actually quite, particularly for these lower values, there's quite a lot of tail out to the right-hand side. So quite a lot of the weight of the density in terms of losses is to this right-hand tail. Okay, we still haven't got anything systemic. All we've done so far is to convert Vasicek into a model which can be used for valuation, and we think a reasonably sensible way. Now we're starting to get to the meat of the problem. So we're thinking at the moment about two banks, so that it could obviously be extended to more, A and B. And we think, the way we're thinking about this is that they choose thresholds for loan termination, KA and KB, again, measured in the same standard deviation metric. And so they foreclose if there's a mistake here, that should be, yes, if there's not a mistake, the outturn for the individual obliger of A, if that could be an AAI, epsilon AI perhaps should be added there, is less than the threshold, which depends on the choice of KA. But these thresholds are both going to be less than there's an equivalent valuation threshold, which is going to, so many loans are impaired, but not all of the impaired loans are then terminated or foreclosed. So that produces fire sales, which will depend, again, it's a nice simple formulation in terms of these thresholds, which depend on the systematic risk factor, KA and KB. And then we bring in, so this is where the parameterization begins to get a bit trickier, an impact on the overall valuation. So this is admittedly rather black box, but it still seems a fairly natural way to bring in a systemic impact.
So K is the rate?
So K is the, going back to the Vasicek setup, which we're trying to keep as closely to as possible. K, it's in units of standard deviation, and it's saying how far an individual obliger has to be from the mean in terms of there to be an impairment.
So you're increasing K? Or?
Yeah, so we're increasing K, exactly. Yes. So that so if it goes from negative to positive, if it's negative, it means most of the obligers are above the threshold and are safe. Whereas if you make K positive, then you're going to get a large majority, then the majority will become impaired. So we're increasing it by essentially this fire sale effect, which we can calibrate. Actually, we want to calibrate it relative to the stock of overall property. But in terms of the modeling, we want to measure it in terms of the overall stock of lending of the bank. So beta represents the share of lending in the total market. And alpha is this fire sale sensitivity. Phi we already have, which is the translation from units of standard deviation to money.
So how should we understand the mechanism which leads from the foreclosure of one loan to the increase in K for other loans which are not subject to...
I guess you're right to question the microeconomics of that. I guess I'm going back to my reading of what happened in terms of commercial property in the UK. So we had quite a lot of foreclosures taking place both in prime and in the non-prime areas over the last 5 years. And the consequence was to push down the surveyors' valuations quite substantially. So it was if a property is coming onto the market, then that's affecting the prices of all the properties kind of in the neighborhood.
If you think about housing loans, then I understand, because when you foreclose, the bank actually becomes the owner of the underlying real estate.
Yeah.
So then they put it on sale.
Yeah.
There's actually a fire sale. There's lots of houses being sold simultaneously. So that will push down the value of the house, which is the collateral of the other loans.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that it affects the other loans. But here I'm not sure what's the nature loans and whether it's the same.
Well, they are mortgages. They're very similar. So commercial property lending is a mortgage secured on an office block or a retail property development. So it's much the same mechanism.
And the property is the collateral?
And the property is the collateral. Yeah, okay, so maybe I should have emphasized a bit more. I think the point is, empirically in the UK, it's been actually this mechanism via commercial property which has hit the banks more.
And is it the same structure that the loan holder is only liable up to the value of the underlying property? Is it the same?
Well, the point is that there's always the possibility of them going bankrupt. So a classic example in the UK would be the Canadian developer Olympia and York, who built the Canary Wharf, the original Canary Wharf Tower. Now, they went bankrupt. And then Barclays was saddled with as the main lender, was then saddled with the building. But they couldn't, there would have been a certain percentage of, there would be a remaining unsecured claim to the extent the loan wasn't covered. But I think in those cases it's much, again, I should probably look at more at the numbers, but recovery values on the unsecured portion of the lending, if the values have fallen sharply, then becomes very low. You're quite right, it's worth our while in the paper trying to build this analogy a little bit further. And this is, with the assumptions we've got so far, you'll still see there's one difficult kind of step in this to come with, but we can then begin to think about capital ratios. So I think there's actually one table in the paper which I haven't put on the slides. We've begun to think about, well, what would a typical balance sheet look like? We really want to focus on, the commercial property exposures. So we think of this as a one-period analysis, but the period we have in mind is probably something like 2 to 3 years. That when you have system-wide problems, it takes quite a long time for exposures in these markets to work out. Again, one of the things we actually think we can do is go through sub-period dynamics, that's one of the possible simulations we can do. But our initial starting point is going to be an initial level of capitalization, CA0, an initial amount of lending, and the ratio of the two. So if we're, the banks we've had in mind, if we call them A and B, I'm thinking probably A is perhaps Halifax Bank of Scotland, and B is Barclays. It's a sort of analogy in mind. Although in the recent crisis, Barclays kept well out of commercial property, but that's because they had the experience of losing a great deal in the 90s on the same exposure. Halifax Bank of Scotland, Royal Bank of Scotland piled in quite substantially. So we're going to look at the things that will matter will be with the ratios LOA compared to LOB, because we can build an asymmetry, but also the ratios of capital to lending, and we can think about one of the banks being relatively better capitalized relative to the other. So we're thinking at their starting point being a situation where the ratio we're looking at sort of 75 to 50 between LA0 for A and L0 for B, and the capitalization ratio is around 6% with a regulatory minimum we can perhaps think of as 4%. And these are then driven by, now the way to understand these equations is that the capital ratios are purely driven by the valuation effect. So all that matters for capitalization is the epsilon star, which depends on the amount of fire sale, KA and KB. So that's this is a formula I've already shown you in terms of K and rho. So it's K minus rho X over square root of 1 minus rho squared. So the impairment mechanism we have will drive capital for both banks, depending on their exposure to the loan market. But the lending will be affected. It's the same equation. The impairments affect the valuation of loans, but there's an additional effect, which actually is a recovery effect. That when they foreclose, which is at the epsilon star A rather than epsilon star, they do actually get some cash back. Doesn't affect their capitalization because they've lost the money, but it does mean that their level of their lending is going to be reduced. It's actually going to be the desire to reduce lending to improve their capitalization that we're looking to model. Now, if we left it at that, we'd have a very boring model, because I'll show you the objective we have in mind in a moment, but essentially what that would be driving firms to do is to put off decisions. They'd say, we'll keep things on the balance sheet. The valuation effects have already happened. But there's still the prospects of return on these new. So we'd rather, if they have unlimited balance sheet capacity, they won't be forced into fire sale. So and this was the biggest struggle, to get something which can work from a. And in the end, we went back to quite work I did with another colleague. Several years ago, we have a quite simple dynamic model of firm capital and bank capital. I guess it's actually the research work for which I'm personally best known. I'm cited quite a bit in so-called context of inventory theories of bank capital. So it's looking at bank capital buffers. And we could have gone down a route which just says there's a capital constraint. So that's probably the most commonly adopted approach in the literature, to say. Balance sheets impinge as soon as you hit the minimum capital requirement, and then you have to sell assets until you satisfy the constraint. But that empirically is not a very good model. It's not bad from a theoretical perspective, but banks never operate with exactly the minimum level of capital. There's always a buffer above the minimum. And so what we want to bring in is something which relates the willingness to maintain loans on the balance sheet rather than conduct a fire sale, that's driven by this balance sheet constraint. And we played around, and we spent quite a bit of time on this. And in the end, the thing that seemed to work most easily was to go back to this very simple specification. I'll show you a little bit. So it's the neat thing about this model is it has an analytical solution which captures the costs or the value of capital on the balance sheet. It's a cash flow model. It has to be highly simplified in order to get, but it gives a very appropriate shape, which I'll show you. And we then want to include an objective, which says, we're not again, another potential challenge to what we're doing is, how does this link to shareholder value or the objectives of management? But we're thinking the management, they want to create capital now and in the future, create value now and in the future. The value that's in the firm is their current capitalization. Now, the only reason that will be affected is that they will be internalizing their fire sale to some extent. So if they conduct a fire sale, that's going to affect valuations, and that's going to impinge back on their own capitalization. They also want to keep loans on the book, and there'll be some profit contribution from their own lending, which is the number parameter, psi. But then we're going to have this valuation effect, which depends on the capital ratio relative to the balance sheet constraint. So we've got three things going on here, two of which argue for keeping loans on the balance sheet, both directly and indirectly, and one which goes in the other direction, which is the constraint. And the balance sheet constraint, if we look at it visually, so this is actually the first derivative, so this is what will be when we... So we can differentiate our objective function, which will help from solution purposes. You don't want me to show you the outcome, because I did that in Mathematica, and it's, if we printed it, it would be about 10 pages of print. So there's somehow lots of... maybe it can be simplified, but the standard tools... So what we're going to get out of this sort of model, whoops, is a cost of... So we've calibrated this to thinking about a capital buffer, which... This is all based around a target capital buffer. So if we have 4% as the minimum, obviously we can change this if we want, and the target buffer might be the order of 2%. By the way, where this will affect in terms of policy conclusions, and I think my own view, I mean, obviously we're constructing the model in a sense to get an answer, but I think much too little of the policy debate around Basel III has actually focused on how do capital buffers operate during a crisis. It's all very well asking, telling firms, we're doubling your capital requirements. You've got to hold, you know, we change the weightings, or you've got to move from 4%, or you're a SIFI, it's got to be 6%, or whatever it happens to be. I forget all the details. But if you don't allow flexibility to use that capital in a crisis, if you're simply moving the CHI, which is where the buffer is, then you're not actually limiting the incentives to fire sales. If you want to, the way we're setting this up, the incentives to fire sale depend very much on the flexibility of using this buffer and perhaps the time that will be given. So, I mean, that's the nature of these buffer capital stock models, on which I've written quite a number of papers. So I'm naturally predisposed to say that the authorities haven't thought about this carefully enough, but it's certainly a potential systemic issue when we and by the way, the other thing I think to point out is that many of our models of fire sales in the academic literature are driven by liquidity, but this is driven by capitalization rather than liquidity. A liquidity shock, a loss of confidence, in terms of is an extra layer that we think we can add into the model, but we haven't even begun to start that work. So we're kind of getting, as I was saying earlier, I'm not running a little bit short of, I think it's my typical over-optimism. I'm a very positive person, and Rama said, come and give a presentation. I said, oh, we're just talking about this paper. This will make a great presentation. I'll have some great simulations by December the 19th, and we just don't have the simulations yet. In a sense, it's a good opportunity. It's the last day, so I hope something relatively informal is not too inappropriate. But I'd actually much appreciate feedback. I've got a few more things to say on the policy side, which I'll come to in a moment. But in terms of the model itself, it's a very simple... Let me summarise in the model and then talk about implications for 5 minutes, and then I'm done. So we're trying to think of a very simple sub-network. And our original idea was then to think about, OK, what are the broader linkages? So we might have some sort of shadow banking sector as well, which creates more of a global and international link. And our argument that we I think ultimately this is going to become two papers. I mean, I think we might even be able to have a chat with Rama over the coffee break, but you know, maybe a simple version of this model could still be submitted by the end of the month to your statistics volume. It might be worth making the effort to do that, though my wife will complain because it's Christmas coming up, but that's a possibility. ultimately we think to set this with a network where there are several networks of this kind. And then the issue we have in mind, which I think will be the second paper and the one we thought about when we wrote an abstract, was, okay, when you're thinking about prudential regulation, is it this sort of sub-network or the overall network level that it's best to focus? I doubt there's a simple answer to that question, but I think when you're, perhaps I was, the way to, I'm getting on to the next slide already. So look, let me step back and summarize what we've done and then talk about what we're hoping still to do. So we're thinking about Bank A and Bank B, we've called them 1 and 2 here. We have a tractable way of modeling the interactions with the commercial property market, which we've tried to be, yes, 5 minutes, tried to be as realistic as possible. I mean, there's certain things about this which I think do match with reality. So again, to go back to the UK experience, and this wasn't in the press, I'm probably breaking some sort of Official Secrets Act. There was a special committee at the Treasury which realized that the big issue in domestic financial market was commercial property. And they literally coordinated. They got all the major lenders, British banks, Irish banks, German banks, round the table once a month and made sure they coordinated the way that they dealt with their impaired loans. The last thing they wanted was to see any of those banks kind of running for the exit and exacerbating the problems. And it's probably now over, but that was a 3-4 year process of managing commercial property exposure in the UK. Remarkably little commented upon in either the financial press or indeed in the academic debate. So that's the reason of the focus on commercial property markets. It just takes time to get these things because it's numerical simulation. It still takes time. One of the things we know we're going to hit, even with two banks, is it's obviously conditional. What Bank A does depends on what Bank B does. So the actual outcome for K, there's going to be a game theoretic and a Nash equilibrium and a coordinated response, which is probably going to involve a lot less impact. We're also expecting to see, and this actually relates to yet another paper of mine, I think one of the things to emphasize about these property markets, these secured property markets, is the highly non-linear behavior. So that you can look back over all the experience of the bankers in an institution, and they just haven't seen a serious deterioration. And yet, when you get an extreme shock, then you get a sudden collapse of value. And we think we're going to be capturing that. And then the final thing we want to add, we can maybe add in, is to think about how is that then exacerbated by a collapse of confidence in money markets, where Bank 2 is then reluctant to lend to Bank 1, because lender of last resort could probably be a possible action there. So next steps, I've already talked about a bit. So we want to allow for the strategic complementarity. We're expecting to see this very highly non-linear. Therefore, coordination is appropriate in some circumstances. As I've said already, allowing capital used in the downturn is important. Large exposure rules and additional fragility. And kind of this is where I come to a stop. But the thing we put in the abstract, and I'm aware there's a couple of other papers here which I really want to have a look at, which deal with similar issues. When you expand into a larger network, is this more about protecting the nodes, or is it more about trying to limit the dissemination through? Now, I haven't quite done the mapping. Our setup is not quite in the same intellectual framework. I think someone who's talked a lot to practical risk managers, I think a key thing we should always be doing is trying to think clearly about what are the driving risk factors. Now here it's X, it's not clear, it's some sort of macroeconomic disturbance. But I think we make a little bit of a mistake if we just assume that for no reason an individual institution can just suddenly go under. And I think Vara Lachara said something similar to this yesterday, that a Jerome Kerviel or something can maybe bring down, could bring down a single institution, but if that's unrelated to what other banks are doing, then that for several reasons, that's probably not. Diversification within the firm means that it's unlikely to be a large firm that collapses for that reason. And even if it is, it's going to be uncorrelated and if a firm collapses when X is around zero, that's actually not, even though it's got a fire sale, it's not such a problem. And I think the final message we'd like to get out of this is, individual institutions, again, I spend a lot of my time more talking with practitioners, engaging with policymakers, not on the formal modelling. But we've gone down a route which I think is not helpful in terms of systemic risk, which is a very confrontational relationship between regulators on the one hand and the banks on the others. I'm not saying the banks are angels, but I think we can get a lot more genuine change in behaviour if we're working with their systems and their... So, you know, starting with the Vasicek model or a similar portfolio credit model and building systemic risk into that seems to me... I suppose there are these... They're both valuable, but I think we should be pursuing two agendas. One agenda, which many people in this room are doing fantastic work on, is to think about the system as a whole in order to help the regulators better observe when systemic risks are rising. But I think the other job, which I don't think we've done enough on, is to work with the risk managers and the individual banks to say, look, there could be systemic problems in the future, they can't be predicted. How are you going to manage your own institution so that you're best protected in that situation? And our type of modelling is, in a sense, focused on that agenda. Okay, that's where I stop. Again, I apologize that there weren't more pretty pictures, but...
Let's thank the speaker.
Okay.
So, it's time for a few questions.
So, I didn't completely get how the feedback effect worked within the context of the Vasicek model. Is it the case that, that somehow the default threshold is moved or the correlation is moved? And can you give some feeling for...
I think it's similar. I think it's similar in spirit to the question that Rama was asking. So, and it does need some filling out. I mean, just to some extent, we've said we want to work with a simple model. There's only two parameters that we can put a systemic impact in. So we could work directly on rho, but it seemed more. And clearly, we observe empirically that there's big increases in correlation of default of losses in crisis, but it seemed more natural to us to think, no, this is a valuation impact, so that when there's a fire sale, that then affects the views of outsiders. These could be surveyors doing the valuations, it could be the view of investors about what's a property exposure worth. But I agree we're a little bit hand waving there, you know, should we try and spend more time to try and make that more structural? I think it would be great if we can, but I don't see a very obvious way to do that other than to say we think a fire sale effect should impact on K. The other difference, of course, is that we're very much focusing on this as a valuation model rather than the default is actually becoming the decision of the write-off is becoming the decision of the bank rather than purely based on the valuation. Does that answer the question, or it's?
I think I need to go back to the formulas.
But I think I was surprised because the more complicated bit of the model, and we can go back to formulas if you want, is more around the bank balance sheet. But you're right. We simply said, I can go back to. So it's this alpha beta. Oops. So I think this is the. So we're simply.
Maybe just one little bit. What was K again? K was...
So the original... K measured in terms of standard deviations is the threshold below which you begin to get impairment on the value of individual loans. And so by increasing this, we're saying a greater proportion of loans are then impaired. And so, the pictures we're getting out of that relationship look plausible. I mean, it's whether. Yeah.
Just change variables. The X factor, so yeah. The systematic factor in the commercial property market. It's one-dimensional for your model, but do you have a proxy in the macroeconomy? Do you have a way of thinking about the X? What is it? It's just the business cycle, or what is it?
I mean, this is something, of course, we've inherited from the Vazacek setup, and so it's always a little bit
commercial property.
For commercial property. I mean, we could certainly look at things like occupancy rates if we wanted to have some sort of metric that's measuring. That would probably be the most obvious place. There's actually a Centre for Commercial Property down the road from us at Loughborough, in one of the Leicester universities. It's worth looking at that a bit more detail.
Would the X for commercial property be like related to the X for residential property? Would they be highly coupled or complementary? Or
there's certainly going to be a lot of correlation, but they're not going to be quite the same. So, but certainly in the UK, I mean, a lot of this is all driven by retail spending. A lot of this is, but you know, City of London. You have two factors in the UK. What's the UK economy driven by? I'd say it's consumer spending and the city. So the city will have a big effect on commercial property, but probably a somewhat lesser effect on the housing market. So I'd expect those two, a fuller model would have two factors with quite a high level of correlation.
Yeah. I actually have a similar question. So I couldn't follow. The KA and KB,
yeah,
are they feeding into, now K is a function of KA and KB, but do they in turn have a dependence on K? So is there like a recursive equation that you have for the traction?
So there's kind of a loop.
Can you repeat a little bit how?
Yes, yeah, so maybe a diagram to sort of show how that. So there's a materialization of the systematic shock with X. So that will then drive valuations, mm-hmm. which then in turn affect bank capitalization. That forces banks, because of this balance sheet constraints, to terminate a certain proportion of their loans. So that in turn, which is their decision about their KA. So KA and KB are the decision variables of the two banks.
Are they a function of the previous K? Previous value of K. So otherwise, this is not a.
No, it's not linear. It's
not a recursive equation.
It's not a recursive equation. No, exactly. Yeah.
So there is a shock. There's new value of KA. Yeah. New value of K.
Yeah.
And then the threshold is higher, and then you have more defaults.
Yeah.
But it's not.
Yeah.
Because for me,
we just couldn't get the simulation probability. But one thing we can see we can get is if you get a large enough X, you can then get pushed to a point where there's no solution. With where they can maintain their capitalization at above, so you can then get pushed to an insolvency.
But the issue is you have a static model,
yeah.
and you want to introduce dynamics. I think an easier way is to just make X dynamic, and because shifting K is equivalent to shifting X.
Sure.
You compare with the threshold.
Yeah.
And the threshold.
But I think actually we're doing K. X is defined as, if you like, as standard deviations from the.
But if you shift the mean of X,
yeah,
then it's like shifting all the obligors towards the bottom.
Yeah.
So I guess that's easier.
Okay, I see what you mean. That's probably an easier way of describing what we're doing. We're shifting all the obligors towards an impairment.
That would be. I guess the Vazacek model is a static version of the Merton model for.
Yeah.
So that's reintroducing the good old Merton model.
Okay, that's a nice way of. I think that's what we're doing, but it's just a different way of describing, a better way of describing what we're doing. Yeah.
Right, because as in a sense, for me, it's a little bit difficult to think that one can capture. So there are things that one can capture about systemic risk that has to be some history or dynamic model where things feed into themselves. And you can still do it in a stochastic. A framework, but you need that the parameters are changing over time, depending on the history, which I agree is not so easy to handle mathematically. But there are tricks by which then it eventually translates into the drift.
No, that's obviously a good
threshold. So you need something like where either the threshold or the drift. Or the variants are changing depending on the history, and then you get the build up.
I agree. Although I think I go back to what I said right at the very beginning. I'm going to present something which is very simplistic, if you like, compared to what many people here are working on. But as I say, coming from a point of view of where I talk to policymakers, I want to start with something as simple as possible. So I think it's a deliberate choice to get this done, and then that becomes the next step to try and think, okay, can we evolve these dynamics in a more realistic way? That's the way I'd prefer to approach that.
Are there further questions? Maybe? So then I think we thank the speaker again.